Succession, number 30493, Reel 10.
Political awareness, it was a resentment, you see. I mean, everybody resented the officers and their superior attitude. It was just the bosses in uniform, you see, to the average soldier. It really was. I mean, I was lucky because I'd worked for my dad. I hadn't experienced being bossed around, except by my dad now and again. But every guy I met had had a boss, or he'd been out of work, or his father had been out of work. How do you explain all this? I mean, there's social history, there's a whole library of books explain it all and describe it all. It's really why I became a bookseller, of course. I had to pursue this discovery, and I wanted to help distribute the literature. I mean, I used to talk politics, I don't know, as I read more and more and thought more and more, I suppose, I used to talk politics with the lads, and of course they'd say, oh, you ought to be an MP, you know, and which is what a compliment. And I could never possibly go into politics, and I never joined a political party, ever. Distrust of politicians really have lived with. Though, of course, I voted left, voted Labour in 1945, and this was absolutely a historic event, and all the commentators couldn't believe it, that this army had been led by Churchill refused to vote for him in 1945. That sums up the political awareness in the army at that time. And that developed through the war, you see, slowly, I think. Isn't it a fascinating part of history, no doubt about it.
Did the chain of command in the army, or the military authorities, take any efforts to suppress or curtail the left-wing books and views, or politics at all?
Well, you see, I mean, all our mail was censored. That's something to remember. So, really, anybody, your officers were pretty much aware from your letters about who you were and what you were. I mean, a lot of the guys were barely literate, you see. You forget how the appalling state of education. I think it's an appalling state today, but then it was appalling then. And I had to help a guy write his letter to his sweetheart or his family. It usually was, what can I say, you know? Well, I don't know quite what to say, mate, you know? And I'd say, well, what kind of weather is it? Look at the weather. And sort of teaching the basics of writing letters home. I'm sorry, I've lost track.
Just wondering about the degree of censorship or otherwise that the military authorities
imposed
upon the troops.
I think it changed when Monty came in. The army, we've been, you know, the army is the last people to change. They're always fighting the last war or the last battle. I've got two or three books by generals. They're much more enlightened today, and they pretty soon discover that in their own lives have become pretty pointless. There's one here by the utility of force by General Sir Rupert Smith, The Art of War in the Modern World. Now, that is a very fascinating book. He's a general who changed his mind. And he's an intellectual general, not many intellectual generals. And there he is, picture on the back there, his red beret, the image of the fighting soldier. Handsome, could go straight into a film. But he read books. Big mistake for the military class. And it just shows how the army's living in the past all the time. The leadership is not very well informed. Look how they were fooled by weapons of mass destruction over Iraq, you know. Well, that's another subject, isn't it? When the war was one disaster after another, we just weren't winning anywhere. The army was running everywhere. You know, it fled from France. I mean, these are horrible terms, fled, because we did. We fled. And Greece, we sent troops to Greece. But Hitler swept them out of Greece. A terrible battle that was. And it was mistakes. Look at the guns in Singapore. They turned out to be facing the wrong way. All these terrible errors have all come to light. And it was because these comfortable brass hats at the top, whose main interests really were hunting, shooting and fishing. You know, what do they do in their leisure time? Wherever the British top people go, the generals, the officer class, they lay on all these upper class pursuits. For instance, in Cairo, we didn't dare go to a big hotel, I forgot what it was called now, the Gezira Hotel. This was this privilege. Here was white colonial privilege, you know, for officers only. And there, they'd be playing tennis and they'd be having their cocktail. Living there, an officer's life, you see. Wherever they went, that was provided on the ship. An officer led a special privileged life, you know. So when they weren't any good fighting, fighting the war. It was defeat, defeat, defeat. There were, Rommel came right up, almost took Cairo. Monty turns up there. And he's sort of represented a devil-may-care. He'd been in the First World War, so he knew exactly what it was all about. But he came in, and one of the first things he did, he dropped this image of immaculateness. The idea that generals and officers all seemed to think they ought to be in immaculate uniform. You know, it was the other ranks, the soldiers, who could get shabby and look dirty and dusty. But the officer always had to sparkle. The Monty put an end to that. He started wearing an Australian hat and a sheepskin coat. And from then on, all the officers started to copy him, you know, dressed how, you know, casually. And it broke down. Yeah, that image alone began to break down this barrier between officer and men. And it was Monty who demanded that officers explain to the men what the military situation was. I think you'll find that what I'm saying, I mean, there are, it's what is there in my head. I think that's pretty true. A lot of what I say may sound exaggerated, you know. War is about exaggeration. That's why Spike Milligan's such a wonderful guy to report it, you know. So communication, it improved, definitely. I mean, you can tell from my diaries, I seem to be quite well informed. It's partly because I read a lot from home. I got critical, the New Statesman, for instance, was always had critical articles about the war. And, you know, I get a copy of the New Statesman sent from this Hampstead friend, and I've got one or two clippings from it. It says, what is happening in Italy? You know, and to read that and to be out there was really quite a revelation. You know, there'd be items of news there that the army wasn't telling us about. And I used to feel that I was better. I really did feel I was better. It sounds so big-headed, but I've not been big-headed. It just happened. I seem to know more about what was going on than the officers did. That's the impression I got. In fact, I know I can prove it. I can tell you a story which sort of proves it. I was more aware and informed than my censoring officer. Have I told you the story of the Argentina Caves Massacre? Have I told you that? You know, I saw the aftermath of a Nazi massacre outside Rome. Have I mentioned that at all? Well, this is one of the most disturbing. Now, I still have. I can conjure up this horror just like that. That hasn't been swept out of my mind. And if I read my diary, it's remarkable. The diary account is different, but much the same. You know, I haven't distorted my visit. We were stationed outside Rome. This would be 1940, sometime 1940, early 45, I suppose. Or 40, it could be late. Anyway. And the army newspaper came out with a big headline. The Nazi massacre unearthed in Argentina cave. Actually, I've got a photo. I don't know at what point I asked somebody to photograph me. And I'm holding the news, that very newspaper up with the headline. So there we are, you see. I had the curiosity. I thought, well, we're only 10 miles outside Rome. I'll go and see for myself. If, you know, it just hits something that's on the, you know, I can reach and see. So I hitchhiked into Rome, and then I took another and hitchhiked again, and it's about, I think, 4 miles outside Rome. You reach this point where the early Christians used to meet in these caves, and they've been there ever since, and they used to practice their religion and defy the Romans years ago. And they're known as the Ardeatini Caves. So I got there, and it was throughout. Now, as I say, the details differ. If I stick to the one that's in my head, it's surrounded by barbed wire. There's an Italian soldier with a rifle on guard. So I go up to him and I say, "È possibile entrare qui? Per favore." He said, "Oh, no, 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 no." So I pulled out a packet of cigarettes from my pocket and gave it to him. I said, "È possibile?" He said, "Oh, see. And the cigarettes saw me in. Now, the next thing, I could see a cave in this sort of mountain or mini mountain, the rocky face. And outside were Red Cross tents, and it was absolutely silent. It was middle of the day. Everybody had knocked off for their siesta. It must have been about 2 o'clock, I suppose, and the sun was blazing down, and they'd all knocked off. There was just one or two sweaty soldiers, Italian soldiers, and one of I went up to one and he offered to take me inside. But as we walked through the caves, I saw the coffins laid out, the just bare deal coffins, empty. And then as we walked through further on, suddenly there were human remains in the coffins, some with a name on top, and others with sort of muslin cover over. They went deep into this sort of mountain. And then suddenly, there was a, I remember the, there was a blazing arc light there. The electricity had been laid on. And this blazing arc light revealed this great heap of mouldering bodies. 330 of them, I discovered later. The resistance movement had noted that an SS, the SS used to march through the centre of Rome every day at the same time. I forgot whether they went with a band or not, but it was either it was to intimidate the Roman citizens. They were struck through, but they always used the same route. So the resistance plotted and put a bomb inside a dust cart, and a dust cart blew up and killed 30 odd SS soldiers, because Hitler immediately ordered 10 Roman citizens to be killed for every dead German soldier within 24 hours. It was an enormous problem for the fascists and the Nazis running Rome. So they just grabbed anybody. None of them been sentenced. They're all on minimal charges, you know, breaking regulations. And it turned out, among those 320 men, there were four generals. There was a whole family of four from 16 upward, father and his sons. The catalogue is horrendous, because they're just Roman citizens, every walk of life. And they were there for the tiniest offences, you know. They were nothing, no major crime. There were the fascist commander had this demand from the Nazi commander. Between them, they shoved this lot into trucks in the dead of night, took them up to the caves, and then shot them in the back of the head one by one. Actually, a very good film was made of this. Unusually for Hollywood film, it was about 80% accurate and 20% invention. Anyway, there we are. I'm in that cave, and I've witnessed this. At this time, you see, none of the death camps have been... none of the death camps have been reached by the Allies, by the Russians, or anybody. It was still... all rumour about mass Nazis committing mass deaths. And here I witnessed the aftermath of an example of Nazis killing innocent people. So immediately when I got home, I wrote this letter saying it's a terrible thing that I'd seen, that I hadn't realised the Nazis really were killing people en masse. Murdering them like that. It's in my letter of outrage, and I thought my parents ought to know. And the sentencing officer called me in and said, "Oh, great, I'm afraid I can't pass this letter." I said, "I'm sorry, sir." He said, "It's not official, this, what you're writing about here. It's just not official, you know." I said, "Well, excuse me, sir, I've just witnessed this terrible thing with my own eyes. It's a Nazi crime, and I think the people at home should know about it. We're fighting the Nazis, aren't we?" He said, "Well, I'm sorry, Gray, I just can't let you send this letter. It's just not official." Now, I know there's a lesson for you. I mean, that was... You couldn't get a bigger gulf, could you, between a soldier and an officer than that. And it revealed that this officer class, they fought Hitler's officers in the desert. Now, the war in the desert was like, it's more like fighting, and other people said this, it was more like fighting a battle at sea, in which the units are manipulated over vast areas, you know. And the officers saw the German officers under Rommel as sort of fellow professionals and gentlemen, really. They thought they were fighting World War One over again, you know. I didn't see them as Nazis. I didn't have any image of what. After all, this same class had appeased Hitler for years and years and years. Why should they suddenly hate him and his men, you know? They were ignorant. And of course, most people were ignorant of the immensity of this crime. The Nazis meant death, mass death, millions. Millions deliberately gas burned. An industry had to be set up. Special gas, thiclum, had to be manufactured to murder Jews, communists, homosexuals, gypsies, all the people that the Nazis hated. The old, the very, very old, are expendable, no useless anymore. I didn't get across to the officer class. I can't. There must have been exceptions, of course, but that was a really shocking lesson for me, I can tell you. I was outraged. I still am all these years later.
Did you make a distinction yourself between the Nazis specifically and Germans as a whole?
Yes, now that is okay, you see. I tell you, I'm just having an amazing experience with these diaries. I can't believe what I'm reading half the time. I describe a horrendous barrage that I'm told that we've got so many artillery regiments all crammed into a 2,000 yard front. And this fire plan is worked out, and all the guns, from the heavy machine guns right up to the biggest long distance guns, and us 25 pound regiments, and the fire plan is worked out, and then suddenly it's off, and this great mass of steel goes shrieking through the air, you know, and you hear it pounding away, and it might go on for an hour. Then it will stop. And in my diary, I describe, you know, the immensity of it all and being part of it. How many shells we fired. I mean, 300 rounds per gun. 300 rounds. Terrific, really. And I'd say, poor devils. I'd say, those poor devils under it at the other end. Over and over again, here's something for you that I cannot. I can hardly believe it. Here we are. Now listen to this, because you won't believe it, you know. I can't believe it. But it must be true, because why should this guy lie to me? In France, an infantryman told me of the life in the Senio line, which had been static for months, till a few days ago. At points, the Germans were in dugouts on one bank of the river, while our lads were in the other bank. Now listen to this. Can you believe this? On one occasion, a parcel came sailing over the water from the German dugout on the other side, containing some kind of pancakes. This sounds like Spike Milligan at work, doesn't it? These were thrown back by the British infantry, definitely Spike Milligan, liberally spread with jam. And then I say, love thine enemies, exclamation mark. Then I say, Now, this is important, you see. Shocking behaviour, no doubt, in the eyes of the armchair German haters back home. But they needn't worry, for those same lads are chasing Jerry up now, none the worse for realising that despite everything, the German is still a human being. Ah, what better example could you have of this weirdness of war on how people behave in it? It's like, earlier on, I don't know whether I mentioned this, the sense I had in the diary, again, from the diary, I don't remember it, the sense that Christmas Day, on both sides, our hearts weren't in it. And the shells seemed to be so few that I thought that there was a sort of a Christmas truce at work, you see. These things happen, it's extraordinary, in wartime. And if you can hardly believe, I mean, can you believe this story about pancakes? I mean, was he having me on? But why should he? You know, I'm talking to an infantryman in Florence on leave, as I was. And I probably would meet, I don't know, meet him in a wine bar or somewhere. And we got chatting. Why should he leave me out of the garden? Sorry. So, you know, we must think that, we must believe it, mustn't we? I think so. But of course, there again, you know, memory. It's not in my memory, amazingly, but there it is, written down the day after I was told it, I suppose. The mysterious process. It really is. I mean, men are told to go out and slaughter other men. They can't hate them all the time, you know. It's a terrible thing.